Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The U.S. military announced this week it will seek the death penalty for six prisoners accused in the attacks of 9/11. Finally, a major trial out of Guantanamo Bay. But will it be fair? With the cases headed for military tribunals, not U.S. courts, this legal process is a world of its own and shadowed by torture. American justice will be on trial alongside the accused. This hour On Point, we'll look at the trial ahead for the Guantanamo Six. Joining me now from Durham, North Carolina, to lay out the situation is Scott Silliman, professor of law at Duke University, where he's executive director of the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security. He served for 25 years in the Air Force, where he began as a judge advocate. In his last military assignment, he led 700 active duty and reserve lawyers and support staff for the force. Scott Silliman, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Tom.
Wish you'd just lay out some of the basics for us here. We've got six men on trial, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who, by his own admission, is said to be a mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, another, the so-called 20th hijacker who didn't make it into the country, and then allegedly involved at the kind of logistics level. We've got charges of murder and conspiracy and more. What is the legal setup into which these men's trials will proceed, Scott Silliman?
Tom, this is the system that Congress created in the fall of 2006 after the Supreme Court struck down the president's first military commission system. And the timeline is that, of course, as your listeners know, on Monday, it was announced that the prosecutors for the military commissions are recommending to the head of the military commission system, Susan Crawford, the convening authority, three things. One, that the charges that you just mentioned be sent to a military commission against those six individuals. Secondly, that those charges be treated as capital, which means that the death penalty would be provided. Mm-hmm. And thirdly, that all six be tried in common, or a single trial for all six, very similar to what was done way back in Nuremberg in the International Tribunal. That recommendation was made. Nothing happens until the convening authority, Judge Crawford, actually approves those recommendations. And at that point, the six must be formally served with the charges. They must be notified of the charges that were approved. And they will be provided lawyers. They will be provided a military-appointed lawyer, and they can have a civilian lawyer, but that civilian lawyer must be a member of a federal or state bar.
So they'll be tried in common, which means we, if cameras were allowed, and I guess they won't be, but we would see all six men in the dock in a row, sort of?
That's correct, Tom. That is the recommendation. Now, again, I want to stress that none of this has been approved yet by Judge Crawford, and all six of the detainees could, through their lawyers, petition to the military judge that they have a separate trial, in other words, that the charge be severed for them. That's something that will obviously come up, and I anticipate that perhaps some of the defense lawyers will request that.
Though, from everything I'm reading so far, the presumption seems to be that whether in common or apart, these trials will go forward. There seems to be a kind of consensus in the Bush administration that this is next on the docket.
That's correct, Tom. Of course, you've got some other trials that have actually started of lesser individuals, Hamdan and Cotter, the Canadian. But certainly these six are the major characters, we believe, that were involved directly in the horrendous attack on the 9th of 11th of 2001, 9th of September. And this is going to be the biggest challenge for this military commission system that Congress set up a year and a half ago.
So we've got charges here: conspiracy, murder, attacking civilians, terrorism, providing material support for terrorism. Not all of these six have been in Guantanamo ever since Guantanamo first opened up after 9/11. Most of them were held in secret CIA prisons, who knows where, for a long time, weren't they?
That's correct. We don't know a whole lot about that, Tom, but we do know that the President of the United States announced some time ago that he was transferring those from the CIA sites to Guantanamo for the purpose of trial. Of course, that does raise a question, which will undoubtedly be raised at trial, about the statements that the government may try to admit in evidence. I'm sure the defense lawyers will try to suggest that those statements should not be admitted, particularly against Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, with regard to a statement that may have been made by waterboarding. As your listeners know, that's a big debate in this country now, whether waterboarding is torture, and the administration has differing positions on it. A military judge is going to have to rule on whether those statements are admissible based on the conditions under which they were taken.
Now, it is a matter of record at this point that he was waterboarded. We don't know about the others, but he was, so that stands there, a coercive interrogation with at least one of the others. Scott Silliman, describe for us, how does this military tribunal work? How is it like and unlike, both in who sits in the courtroom and what they do and what's permitted? How is it like and unlike a court on the, you know, in the mainland USA, in the normal U.S. justice system?
Well, one difference, Tom, is you're going to have a whole lot of folks in a military uniform, because the military judge, who is chosen from sitting military judges in the different services, these are actually practicing military judges, one will be appointed for this particular military commission.
Who appoints?
The chief trial judge actually appoints. There is a pool of military judges that have been made available, and one of those pool is designated as the chief trial judge, and he will actually select or detail a particular military judge for this commission just the way he has for the prior commissions.
What do you think they'll look for in choosing this judge? Do military judges, like civilian, have reputations? Are there hanging judges and, you know, more judicious judges?
No, I think not, Tom. I think what they're going to be looking for is a military judge who is very seasoned, who has dealt with capital cases where the death penalty was authorized. You require a very seasoned, experienced judge, because the whole world will be watching what we do in this particular commission. I believe it's fair to say that much of the world believes this is an unfair system, or presumes it's an unfair system. So whatever is done at Guantanamo Bay must be with a view of showing the rest of the world and the American people that the system Congress set up can work and will be fair.
That widely disputed, but let's look more closely. What about the jury? They'll all be in uniform, I guess. How will they be? What's the jury pool? How are they chosen? Can they be, you know, bumped by defense attorneys or others?
Yes, they can, Tom. The qualifications to be a member of the jury pool are identical to the qualifications for military courts-martial that we use for armed servicemen. Susan Crawford, the convening authority, must choose those who are best qualified for duty by reason of age, education, training, experience, length of service, judicial temperament, and she should not look for someone who is a hard officer or someone who served on courts-martial and gave hard sentences. That's not a part of the qualification. But if these charges are referred as capital, Tom, by Judge Crawford, then you're going to have 12 members of that military commission, and all 12 must agree for any sentence going to death.
Take us then to the points of controversy here. What's admissible and what's not? Procedurally, you know, where is this tribunal vulnerable to criticism as the whole world watches, as you say?
Well, it's going to be criticized, I'm sure, if any statements are admitted that were taken under any kind of coercion. Congress set up a particular test for the military judge to use. Congress said very clearly, if any statement was taken by torture, as torture is defined in law, then it can never be admissible under any condition. Now, if it's something less than torture, and again, I'm going back to the debate on waterboarding, is it torture, is it something less? Then a military judge may allow into evidence a statement that was taken under conditions that are less than torture, but nonetheless coercion. And he's got to make the determination whether the totality of the circumstances renders that statement reliable and possessing sufficient probative value, and the interests of justice would best be served by admitting that statement into evidence.
They're sending in a clean teams to do fresh interviews or interrogations, I'm not sure what to use, word to use, that would not be coerced. But can any interview be, you know, clean after torture has once been used?
Well, that's a question that will obviously come up in the commission, Tom, and it's going to have to be something ruled on by the military judge. What we call the exclusionary rule in our constitutional law that prohibits derivative evidence from a prohibited act may or may not apply in a military commission, because we don't know how much of the Constitution applies to those at Guantanamo Bay. But the military judge is going to have to make a determination, regardless of how, quote, the clean team operated and gave people coffee and things like this.
Yep.
I believe the defense counsel would probably be raising this question of it's nonetheless tainted, and that's going to be an issue for the military judge, and Tom, I suggest probably one that will go up on appeal.
Jury would have to be unanimous for the death sentence?
That's correct. That's the way Congress set it out.
And what about the timetable here? Is this likely at all to unfold under George W. Bush, who oversaw this era of Guantanamo, or will this fall under the likely under the next presidency?
It's difficult to predict, Tom, but I suggest probably it will spill over into the next administration. Again, the timeline is once Judge Crawford approves all these three recommendations made by the trial team, then within 30 days, each detainee must be arraigned and allowed to plea. Then the military judge sets a date for discovery and motions, and we don't know how long that's going to take. It could take a long time. The defense counsel, obviously, in dealing with capital charges, are going to want to take as much time as they can to defend their clients to the best of their ability.
But so it clearly could unfold under a President Clinton or a President Obama or a President McCain, John McCain, prominently in the GOP saying no to torture. Could the next president sort of throw it all out and have it start over again in a different venue?
Well, not really, Tom. Again, you're dealing with an act of Congress here, and Congress set the rules. So unless Congress goes back and amends the Military Commission Act of 2006, under which these trials are proceeding, the president is not going to have a whole lot to say about whether the trials proceed or not. Now, the president has to approve, personally approve, any death execution. So if you have death, then whoever the president is, ultimately, after President Bush, is going to have to make that determination, whether to approve the execution or not.
Scott Silliman is professor of law at Duke University, served for 25 years in Air Force legal work. He spoke with us from Durham, North Carolina. Professor Silliman, thanks very much for laying out the terms of the trial for us.
My pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Guantanamo Six. The U.S. government now seeking the death penalty against six Guantanamo prisoners facing charges this week of murder and conspiracy in the attacks of 9/11, and looking at the issues of torture and fair trial that swirl around their cases. We're going to hear today from two former military attorneys with quite different views of what's unfolding at Guantanamo. Joining me first from Concord, New Hampshire, is John Hudson, Dean of the Franklin Pierce Law Center. He was Judge Advocate General of the U.S. Navy from 1997 to 2000. He began serving as a Navy Judge Advocate in 1972. John Hudson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Tom, it's a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Fort Mitchell, Kentucky, is John Bickers, professor at the Chase College of Law at Northern Kentucky University. He served as an Army Judge Advocate for 15 years. John Bickers, thank you for joining us.
You're quite welcome, Tom.
John Hudson, first to you. You began in a kind of favorable attitude toward the military tribunals being put to work in this decade, and you've ended up somewhere else. How do you see what's about to unfold, apparently, in Guantanamo Bay here?
You're right. I was an early and ardent advocate for military commissions, but I have, you know, I've done a 180 just because of the way it has been implemented and the torturous path, so to speak, to coin a phrase that that they've taken. You know, I think these people need to be prosecuted. Mm-hmm. They need to be convicted if they're found guilty and sentenced, but it needs to be done in such a way that's completely above reproach. And we've gone, ironically, I guess, in some respects, we've gone too fast on these. As Scott pointed out, and we've got a death penalty case. So, you know, as the legal maxim says, death is different.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying them all together, which complicates it. As Scott pointed out, we don't even know if the Constitution applies or to what extent it applies.
The Supreme Court is still considering that.
The Supreme Court is still considering that. So we don't know if the exclusionary rule applies. So that what, you know, prosecutors traditionally typically want to try the easy cases and kind of the low-hanging fruit first.
But in the case of Guantanamo, there have been almost no trials, or maybe no trials out of it.
Well, there's been one case.
One plea.
Hicks from Australia pled guilty and got 9 months. So we didn't really try it. You know, we haven't really gotten the kinks out. And, you know, we started two different cases where the judges in two separate cases dismissed them without prejudice because there wasn't jurisdiction because they had been pled improperly. So that, you know, we need to work this out so that when we get to people like El-Khatani and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, we know for sure that this is going to work. we've got the best legal system on the face of the earth in the U.S. federal court system or the military court-martial system under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The federal courts have successfully prosecuted Padilla. They prosecuted Zacharias Moussaoui. They've prosecuted any number of terrorists. They can do this. So why we hide that, I think it's a mistake to hide that system under a bushel. Why we do a test run on the military commissions with people like KSM and Al-Qatar.
Sort of going 0 to 60 here with two of the six, as you say, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Al-Qatani, the so-called 20th hijacker. We'll look at the details of your concern there, but John Bickers, let me come first to you. You're quite supportive of what is getting up on the rails to proceed here at Guantanamo in relation to these six men. Why?
Well, I'm very hopeful that we can at last do this the right way. I'm fully in agreement with Dean Hudson that some terrible, terrible choices have been made over the past few years. Although I would disagree that we're going too fast, I think if there is a danger, it is that we have gone too slowly. I think what this forum offers the United States and the world is the opportunity to show these men and what the prosecution says they have evidence that they did. And that's something that I don't think would be available in a much more conventional criminal trial in the federal system.
Why will this be better? You won't have TV cameras in there, but I guess you would have reporters. Why is this venue more amenable to the government kind of telling a story about what they allege happened than a regular courtroom?
I think, and this is going to sound counterintuitive for an American audience, because of rules of evidence. In the common law system, we have a very intricate set of rules of evidence, and we allow certain things and don't allow certain things. One scholar said it's the only legal system built on hiding facts from the finder of fact. With the military commissions, which are much more like the international tribunals, not just the ones that were used in Nuremberg, but the ones that were used much more recently for Yugoslavia and Rwandan war crimes, evidence can be introduced that is probative, that is relevant, that is reasonable, that is understandable. And pictures can be painted and events can be shown and subject to criticism and harsh cross-examination and fierce advocacy by a zealous defense bar. But this is the opportunity to get in evidence without worrying about chains of custody or hearsay that will prevent, in a war crime setting, a lot of evidence from ever appearing before the finder of fact or before those who are spectators in the gallery.
Now, John Bickers, you know that the line of critique there, the criticism is, and I've read a lot of it here, people saying the problem is it looks like the outcome is already engineered, already understood before the trial even begins, and that with these rules of evidence, you know, you may be seen as telling any story you want to tell.
I don't think that's a fair criticism. I think it misunderstands the nature of military panels, which are functionally juries, but for a variety of reasons they're called panels in the military. There were acquittals at Nuremberg. There have been acquittals in the military system throughout its history. I had some unfortunately when I was a prosecutor, some when I was a defense counsel. But I don't think there's anything inherently biased against these men in the system that wouldn't be true anywhere. When anyone is accused of a particularly vicious and heinous crime, you have on the defense side a huge burden to overcome. And we talk about presumption of innocence, but that's not exactly what's going on in the hearts of jurors when they sit down in the jury box for the first time. Mm.
John Hudson, Scott Silliman reminded us the whole world will be watching here, particularly with the death penalty on the line. We've already heard from high-ranking officials among allies, London and elsewhere, deep unease over what they see unfolding here. Do you think, with all of your experience, do you think this will be seen as a just trial, a kangaroo court? What?
Well, that's the big question. You know, the appearance of justice is important. Justice itself is important in the abstract, but the appearance of it is very important too. And if the international, domestic and international community come away from these trials, and we won't know till they're over, but if they come away from these trials with the a lack of confidence, it is really going to undermine the status of American jurisprudence. You know, we have an opportunity here to really show off what a great country we are. We also have the opportunity to mess this up again. And, you know, if the Supreme Court takes the case of KSM and overturns it for, you know, some technicality or for something
Muhammad,
really significant.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is really going to hurt us so that, you know, we ought to resolve what the rules are. You know, I'll quote Robert Jackson, who was the chief prosecutor at Nuremberg and later became a Supreme Court justice, who said, "We must never forget that the record on which we judge these defendants at Nuremberg is the record on which history will judge us tomorrow. To pass these defendants a poison chalice is to put it to our own lips as well." Mm-hmm. You know, we need to be sure that these trials end up being perceived by the public, domestically and internationally, as trials that we would want our own troops to endure.
And do you think we're on track to achieve that perception, that level of justice right now?
No. I think that, first of all, as Scott pointed out, you know, the whole world believes the system is unfair. You know, whether that's unfair or not remains to be seen, I guess. But the world believes it to be unfair so that the burden of proof is already on us. And I just don't think that you're going to be able to try death penalty cases for six people simultaneously in a court that has never tried a single case before. You know, I take John's point about his disagreement with whether it's too fast or too slow. It's been 5 years.
Long time.
You know, it's hard to say it's too fast. But the defense shop, the defense counsel, aren't there yet. They don't have a skiff. They don't have a secure room in which to observe evidence.
Not there yet, as the military has over these years amassed whatever they're going to bring to the trial.
Yeah, you know, the prosecution the prosecution has been, you know, the government's had these cases for a long time. There are six defense counsel presently, none of whom are death penalty qualified, I believe, and they've all got other cases. So that, you know, we haven't geared this thing up. You know, we suddenly have got six defendants who are going to capital cases without somebody to receive them and you know, the translators and so forth. So in that sense, you know, too fast may not be the right phrase, but we're not ready for these cases yet.
Those cautions from the former Judge Advocate General of the U.S. Navy with us today, John Hudson. John Vickers is with us as well from Northern Kentucky University. Let's go to our listeners. Mike is calling from Augusta, Georgia. Mike, what do you see?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to make a couple quick points. These guys have been held in CIA black sites for 6 years. They've been tortured. They'll confess to anything. As far as my understanding of the Military Commissions Act, the defense isn't even privy to a lot of the evidence against the detainees. And personally,
they may ultimately be, but the defendants will not be allowed to see classified information, right? Yeah.
Okay. And personally, in my opinion, there's more evidence to indict the military-industrial complex and rogue criminal elements in our own government than there is to go after these guys.
It sounds like a thumbs down from Augusta, Georgia there, Mike. Thank you for your call. Let's get another from Hull, Massachusetts. We've got Bill on the line. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
My concern is that, as your guests have pointed out, this is going to be a major chance for the United States to kind of stand tall in the world and demonstrate how good its judicial system works. The perception of us around the world is really going to be colored by how these trials come out. My concern is that even if the tribunals are absolutely run directly according to the book and these detainees and defendants are given totally fair trials, if they're found guilty, the perception is going to be, wow, this was a done deal ahead of time. They were just kind of railroaded through.
But can't the world understand? 9/11 happened. Everybody's seen those towers come down. Somebody did it. I mean, it does make sense that you might find those people, bring them to trial, and convict them.
Oh, absolutely. but I just am concerned that, you know, sometimes in a trial, the perception might be, especially around the world, in this particular case where these detainees are not going to be tried in the regular federal court system, they're going to be tried in these military tribunals, that in fact, if they are found guilty after getting a totally fair hearing, and the evidence all points to their guilt, and that's the conclusion, that the rest of the world is going to say, oh, this was just a typical Bush administration railroad job. This was a done deal. These guys were guilty before they were even indicted.
Though our guest John Hudson says he's concerned they won't get that totally fair trial. John Bickers, let me come to you. Why this venue? Why not? I mean, if there's that much on the line in terms of the U.S. reputation around the world, which seems to matter right now, why not put it in the U.S. court system, as John Hudson suggests, as an alternative?
Because the U.S. court system is brilliantly designed to determine the guilt or innocence of an individual. And Bill's question, I think, was precisely the right one. Might it not look bad to the world? I think, to the extent that the world is cynical about the United States, a trial in a federal court of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, which would almost certainly be by himself, would not do anything to assuage that. On the other hand, in a military commission's format where you can have a relatively open exchange of information, and that goes for both sides, but the computer that's found in a safe house that we don't have a chain of custody on, we don't know where it came from, can be introduced. We have all six people, all of the victims who died on September 11th are listed in the charges, so the military commission's prosecutors could conceivably call in family members from Egypt, from Jordan, from the Philippines, people who lost loved ones on September 11th, to talk about the impact to them of the activities of al-Qaeda.
Good drama, but could look like, you know, stacked theater.
Well, there is a public education component to international tribunals and military commissions that there isn't to an ordinary trial. Since John Hudson had a Robert Jackson quote, I think it's fair to add that one of the things he said afterwards in his report to President Truman as he's returning to the Supreme Court...
Mm-hmm. From Nuremberg.
That, I'm sorry?
From Nuremberg.
From Nuremberg, right. Mm-hmm. He said, this trial was never about just these broken and discredited men. It was about teaching the world what they had done. If this sort of large group of six military commission is done properly, this can be a forum for teaching the world what has been done. Nothing's going to erase the fact that we really made some poor choices over the past few years, keeping them in secret custody, possibly treating them horribly. But something can be done to show the world that we fixed it now. I think a federal trial doesn't do that.
Wow. John Hudson, would you have the, I don't know, courage to bring this into the federal court system and, you know, live with all the tighter rules of that system? Could justice be done in that case?
Yeah, I think so. And yes, I would. That's precisely what I'd do, either that or military courts-martial, which is kind of attractive to me also. But I think that the federal courts have demonstrated their ability to try these kinds of cases. They've done it. You know, we've got examples of it. You know, we don't have any examples of where the military commissions have worked. So, I think that that's the safer bet. Not perfect, but the safer bet.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the U.S. government now seeking the death penalty against six Guantanamo prisoners facing charges this week of murder and conspiracy in the attacks of 9/11 and the issues of torture and fair trial that swirl around their cases. We've been talking with John Hudson, former Advocate General of the U.S. Navy, now Dean at Franklin Pierce Law Center, joining us from Concord, New Hampshire, and from Fort Mitchell, Kentucky, John Bickers, served as Army Judge Advocate for 15 years, now professor at the Chase College of Law at Northern Kentucky University. Of course, we've got Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, alleged mastermind of September 11th, among these six, and five others who allegedly participated. The government has moved to re-interview the detainees in order to more legitimately obtain evidence originally gleaned using coercive methods, waterboarding in Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's case, acknowledged last week by the government. Of the six men charged, Mohammed and four others were held for as long as 3 years in secret CIA prisons, part of what the agency called its high-value terrorist interrogation program. So the stage is set for some pretty high drama here. I want to look at the context around that politically for a moment. Michael Isikoff joins us from Washington. He's investigative correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Michael Isikoff, thanks a lot for being here.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Put this in a political context. I mean, it didn't happen for years. Now it's happening as President Bush is on the home stretch to the end of his term in office. Do you see the White House wanting these trials now, or is this just the wheels of justice happening to end up at this point in time?
Well, I think it is a sort of happy coincidence, at least, for the White House to have the central trial of 9/11, at least the proceedings begin, while the president is still in office in an election year. A lot of us thought that they were going to tool this up for the 2004 election. But there were so many logistical and legal hurdles in getting these military tribunal trials off the ground that they're just incapable of doing it. It remains to be seen whether we'll get how far they'll get before the November election. But it's certainly helpful to the president and the Republicans to have 9/11 being talked about during the fall campaign.
Is it helpful, even though the man who's now described as, you know, the sort of Republican nominee in waiting, John McCain, has been so outspoken against torture?
Excellent point. And as recently as yesterday, John McCain voted against most Republicans in banning waterboarding, in an amendment to ban waterboarding from any further interrogation techniques. This has been one issue where John McCain has been on the opposite side from the president, the vice president, and most of his colleagues in the Republican caucus.
Secretary of State Rice, among others, has pushed for, we're told, you know, Guantanamo to maybe be shuttered, shut down.
There has been talk about doing that for some time, and I think anybody, particularly in the diplomatic arena, knows how much Guantanamo and the issues of torture and waterboarding have hurt the United States around the world. I mean, that's just, you get that from senior people in the administration who have worked these issues all the time. But on the other side is, in shutting down Gitmo, what do we do with these people? Where do we put them? How do we, what becomes of them? And on the torture issue, you got, you do have these high-value detainees, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi bin al-Shib, and others who were directly involved in plotting and executing the 9/11 attacks, there are big trade-offs here. I think that people in the administration will say, when people hear the full story and understand who we're talking about and what bad guys these were, the opposition and to torture might lessen a bit, that it won't look as bad. On the other hand, there are other people who do know the nitty-gritty details of what we did to these guys who say that there are going to be a lot of people offended, and it could well shock the conscience, in the legal terminology, when some tribunal gets to air exactly what happened here. We don't know until we know the full details of exactly how these people were interrogated, what happened, what was done to them, and we have yet to get the full story on that.
Given the reputation of Guantanamo internationally, Michael, at this point, and just looking on as a kind of civilian observer, but a well-placed one, do you see any way the United States could hold a judicial procedure aiming at death, or let's say aiming at death, that the world would believe in? You know, what if we brought it right into the federal courts on the mainland USA? Would that solve it, or are we up against?
Well, no, you simply cannot have a criminal trial of these people in federal courts because of the torture issue. I mean,
it would just be thrown out from the
criminal trials. Mm-hmm. Once there would inevitably be a full airing of the treatment and apparent abuse of these detainees, and it would be very hard to see how you could get very far in a federal court once that was fully explored. I think the hope of the administration is that the military tribunals will have a lesser standard. It'll be up to the judges to determine how much of the waterboarding issues get explored in the trial. And the standard, the way Congress wrote the law, is evidence gleaned from techniques such as that can be admissible if it's viewed as having probative value. Sufficient probative value, I think, of the is the phrase, and that's a subjective standard in which the judge and jurors are going it's going to be up to them to decide.
Michael Isikoff with Newsweek joining us from Washington. Michael, thanks a lot for being here.
Sure enough, anytime.
Let's go to our listeners. Jolie in Oxford, Iowa. Hi, Jolie, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know why the trials aren't held at The Hague or some objective place where they could be above board, transparent, and the world wouldn't hate us. And also, when are those who conspired to attack Iraq going on trial? The death, destruction, and suffering in Iraq makes 9/11 look like a friendly picnic.
Jolie, you're a tough inquisitor. John Hudson, what about venue? You say bring it into the U.S. court system. You heard Michael Isikoff say no. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Jolie says, let's get it out of here entirely. Put it in The Hague. Put it somewhere, you know, neutral, third country.
Theoretically, you could do that. I mean, you know, like the Rwanda tribunals or, you know, something like that. That's a theoretical possibility. I think it's my opinion is that it is the responsibility of the United States to try these people, and practically and theoretically, it's very unlikely that we would ever turn that responsibility over to third party. And I think that we can do it. I disagree with
Michael.
With Michael, obviously, I guess I disagree mm-hmm. with him because I think that it can be done in federal court. If you know, if what he's saying is that you've got to do it here in commissions because, you know, kind of on his bad guy theory, you know, that they're when they see what bad guys they are, that will sort of justify torture.
Or that the U.S. courts would say all this evidence is too tainted. There's just
right,
it'd be
right.
out it goes and you're left with no case.
Right. And so that the commissions are going to lower the standards so far, you know, the rules of evidence would become so de minimis that you can convict anybody, you know, then we're in a real box. You know, if that's the problem, then, you know, we may just not be able to prosecute it. You know, one of the problems we've got here is that we're, to some extent, I think we're mixing the warfighting function and the Article III court kinds of functions. You know,
that's interesting. What do you mean by that? War on terror plus justice in one bag?
Right. We've got this, you know, we've got this global war on terror, and in that context, we want to have this pure, pristine prosecution, mm-hmm. and they just don't mix. And that's why I'm saying, you know, let the United States fight the war on terror. But if you're going to prosecute people, then it should be in an Article III court where.
What does that mean, not, Article 3 court?
I'm sorry, mm-hmm. Article 3 of the a federal court.
Uh-huh.
Article 3 of the Constitution being the judiciary right. as opposed to the executive branch.
Mm-hmm.
And then that way, it is cleaner, less subject to criticism because it's not the same arm of the government that is prosecuting the war fighting that is then responsible for the prosecution. I think that that confusion causes people to be skeptical of, you know, these are the people you're trying to kill, and now you're just going to prosecute them.
Kind of a structural problem,
right.
at least as it looks. And, of course, Jolie wants to start a whole new trial in the Iraq direction. Duly noted. Jack is calling from Brockton, Massachusetts. Jack, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
It's almost hard to know where to start with the lawlessness of the Bush administration, but I wanted to get back to...
What's your starting point, Jack? Are you an attorney?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I am. And that's why I wanted to start with something that Professor Solomon said. He used the phrase derivative evidence. And there's a wonderful phrase at the law that says that derivative evidence is described as fruit of the poisonous tree. And it's hard to imagine a tree more poisonous than this. The government brings in so-called clean teams, leaving aside the fact that that implies that the first teams were dirty. But
doing the rough stuff, the rough interrogation, waterboarding, torture, if you like.
Exactly. And after these prisoners are treated that way, they're expected to accept the assurance of the government, oh, forget about all that, don't worry about matching what you say in response to our questions to earlier stories, you're going to be fine, we won't hurt you anymore.
But you know, Vice President Cheney and others have said, look, this early rough stuff was because we faced a potentially imminent threat.
That's very difficult to believe, and even if it were true, I do have to say, there's all this disagreement within the government about, I think it's very disingenuous of the government to say that waterboarding is not torture, that it's not beyond the pale. Very recently I was reading what was, without using the term waterboarding, a very clear and graphic account of what waterboarding is. The problem was I wasn't reading it in the newspaper or Time magazine. It was a book about the Spanish Inquisition.
No.
Now, for heaven's sake, if 500 years ago this was regarded as brutal treatment, how can the government be so disingenuous now as to say, well, there are circumstances under which we're going to justify this treatment?
Jack, let me put your point to John Bickers. John, how do you come in after the rough stuff with the so-called clean team, you know, re-interview, and then bring that to the tribunal saying, well, this was done right? You know, Jack, our caller, Jack says, those defendants are going to be, you know, perhaps terrorized in advance. You know, why can we believe that they'll coolly and honestly share? They may feel they have to say this or it starts again.
Oh, I'm in complete agreement with Jack. I think he's absolutely right. And I think if Michael is right in his observation that the administration thinks that the distinction between this forum and a federal court is more ability to use evidence that's derived from cruel, inhuman, or degrading techniques, I think they're in for a surprise. I think the uniformed community has been, by and large, those who have stepped up and said, don't be ridiculous. Of course waterboarding is torture. And don't be ridiculous and think that you can torture someone and still be all right. My assumption is that these commissions are not, in fact, going to use that kind of evidence because the rules clearly say no torture, and they clearly say coerced evidence, if there's even a hint of coercion, only to the extent not only that it's reliable and probative, which was mentioned earlier, but also that it's in the interests of justice. And I don't know how, I'm in agreement with Jack, I don't know how you cure the taint of that sort of treatment.
But with their discretion to decide there, let's get a call from Myrtle Beach and Richard. Hi, Richard. You're on the air, sir.
Hi. How you doing? Right. You know what? I don't get the whole conversation. Let me tell you something. Who cares about what the world thinks? Let's get it on. Let's get these guys on trial if they're guilty. You know, an eye for an eye. Oh, this is ridiculous. You guys are sitting around talking about what the world thinks. Who cares? The Arab nations don't care about what we think. Nobody cares about that.
Richard, our time's short, but your point is loud and clear. Let us pick it up. John Hudson, you spent a long time in the U.S. Navy. Our caller says, who cares what the world thinks? What do you say to that? Eye for an eye.
Well, you know, in the war on terror, it's a battle of ideas and ideals, I think. You know, that's how we won the Cold War, was that, you know, our ideas and our ideals were better than theirs were. And, you know, if the goal of the terrorists is to bring us down to them, and so that in this particular war, it's particularly important for us to rise above all of that and not forget who we are and be true to ourselves, so to speak. And so that, I think that every step we take in diminishing ourselves brings us down to their level, and we start to look more like them. And I don't think that, with great respect to the caller, I don't think that that's what the United States wants to do.
John Hudson, there's the voice of a Navy man. John Bickers, you spent a long time in the Army. You hear our caller. He says, come on, eye for an eye. Let's get going. Who cares what the world thinks? Let's do it.
The one piece where I think he's responding to an earlier caller is Jolie's observation that this should go to the Netherlands, where the death penalty would be unavailable, and I think that would be intolerable to large sections of the American public.
Mm-hmm.
But it does matter what the world thinks of us in this sense. We are dealing with insurgencies at various places in the world, and how we are thought of makes a difference as to whether someone joins an insurgency or not. The various senior public figures can say what they will, but if someone were to waterboard my child or my brother or your child or your brother, Tom, I assume that organization would make of us implacable and fierce enemies for life. And that's the danger that we get into if we say the world opinion doesn't matter.
Yeah, count on that. John Bickers, John Hudson, we're grateful to both of you. When this gets cranked up, I hope you'll come and speak with us again. John Hudson, former Judge Advocate General of the U.S. Navy, now at Franklin Pierce Law Center, Dean there. John, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And John Bickers at the Northern Kentucky University Chase College of Law. Professor Bickers, thanks very much for being here today.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.